Anonymous. You can't hear me? What? It's feeding back if I get too close. We'll try. It's just an honor to be asked to give back. I can't begin to give back as much as I've been given here. I was not one of those people who walked through the doors and said, "Oh, thank God I'm home. I want what you have," you know. Every now and then, you know, maybe I saw somebody, I wanted what they had, but I was not happy to be here. If you're new and you're not happy to be here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's okay. You don't have to be happy to be here. Actually, happy people really made me kind of want to puke when I was new. All you saw was teeth and phone numbers coming at you. It was awful. You guys got a great place here. This is beautiful. I love Alcoholics Anonymous in action in places like this. And we just had fun hanging out. We got here. Elizabeth's been a great hostess. She ran and got us water, and we got here. And I had barely, you know, finished and put it down, and she was at my elbow with another cold one. And I just thought, damn, where were you when I drank? You know, I could have used a friend like you. Of course, you'd probably be in that other 12-step program now. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 6 or 7 years old. My dad got sober when I was a small child. Knowing about Alcoholics Anonymous will not keep you sober. He told me about the drama and tragic loss of his drinking, and when I took a drink at 15 years old, I felt really bad for him that he'd had such a hard time. I just thought some people shouldn't drink, Dad. But that wasn't me. But long before I drank, you know, the big book says a bottle's but a symptom, and, you know, when we're new, we go, yeah, whatever, you know, because I really thought I didn't really want to stop drinking. I just wanted to drink with no consequence, but I could never figure out how to do that. The longer I'm here, the more I find out that all I was missing was the beer before I got here. The longer I read the big book, the more I see myself in it. I never thought, I mean, it was normal to me because it was my head, but, you know, you hear people say they used to always wait for the alien ship to come pick them up, and I never felt like that. I wanted them to come get you off of my planet. I had this mild sense of entitlement. I always had one good friend at a time. Don't talk to my friend, because if she likes you better, I'll have to go find another friend, you know, and you guys will talk about me, and you'll tell your friends, and they'll tell their friends, and they'll tell their friends, and then everybody will be talking about me, and when I come in, you'll all laugh, and I'll have to leave town. Now, this was in first grade when I'm thinking like this. This was not as an adult, you know. I came around AA, and they said something about being self-centered, and I just thought, well, I thought that meant selfish and vain, and I wasn't selfish. I was the most loving, giving person I know. Just ask me. So, you know, that took care of vanity, too. And I didn't understand that self-centered meant how I had lived my whole life, that if I couldn't win, I don't want to play. I would never try anything new in public because there was a risk of failing in front of you, and then you would laugh at me. The one good friend at a time. I never put together that people who were good at things maybe practiced to get good. I just thought, how nice for you that you can do it. I never put together that people who were good at the piano couldn't come out and play because they had piano lessons. I just thought, well, how nice for you that you can play the piano. I just thought I should be able to sit down and play. And I didn't really see that in action until my kids were a little older. When I got sober, my children were 4 and 6 years old, and I had a 6-year-old boy and a 4-year-old girl. They were not in my custody at the time. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the 4-year-old, we would have told you, would be here by now. She had a gleam in her eye. She could lie. It was an art form, you know. You'd say, "Sarah, why didn't you put your clothes away?" And she'd say, "I did," and they'd be in a pile at her feet. And she'd look right at you and go, "I did. I don't know how those got there. I put them away." And so Chuck and I used to tell people, you know, a lot of people save for college. We're saving for treatment. And when she was 11 years old, she wanted to be on a swim team. So we took and got her a few lessons. And she went and tried out for the team a lot of her friends were on. And the coach told her, well, you can be on the team, but you can't really keep up with your age group yet, so we want you to practice down in age group. Now, this man at 11 years old, he wanted her to practice with the 9-year-olds. And she was okay with that. That would not have been okay with me. I'm always a little embarrassed to say I was 7 years sober when this happened, and I was having a hard time being the mom of the 11-year-old that was swimming with the 9-year-olds, because how am I going to look, for God's sakes, you know? I mean, what's wrong with your kid? She's, you know, she's slow. And so she practiced down at age group. She was fine with that. She went to her first race, and these were USS teams where they post, you know, they just run heats and post the results. She was 70th out of 72 in her first race, and she went back the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate. You know, I couldn't have done it. I would have quit. And we told her, you know, Sarah, now you have a baseline time, and even if you don't win your next race, if you beat that time, you've had a successful race. And the whole time I was telling her that, I was thinking, yeah, right. You know, I mean, my parents told me the same thing when I swam. I knew they just had to tell me that stuff. I never bought into it. She beat her time. She was happy. Now, the rest of that story is that 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer. She swam all over the Midwest, you know, in age group swimming. And I would have missed every bit of that the day they told me to swim with the 9-year-olds. And at 11 years old, she had never had a drink, and neither had I. So I realized that we just reacted completely differently to life. And now we kind of think she doesn't really even react to life. She just lives life, which, you know, is a foreign concept to me. But we started watching her with interest, you know, Chuck and I, because by now we're just saying, do you think she's normal? Like, we would know normal if we saw it, you know. And she just took that weird turn on us, you know. We had high hopes for her as a future member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then all down the tube. She got normal on us. And, you know, she graduated from high school in 12 years with the same friends that she started first grade with. Her first summer job, she saved $500. Who does that, you know? At one point, finally, she was about 14, and we said, you know, there's supposed to be one mature one in the house. Congratulations. We think it might be you. But, you know, what watching all of that transpire did for me was it made me realize how acutely involved with myself I was, even as a child, that I always felt like everybody was watching me. I was a spectator in my own life. I had this little camera out here that kind of watched all of you watch me. I couldn't do a thing without being aware of how it looked over here. I was hugely afraid of looking bad. I lived by rules that nobody ever taught me. One of them was never, ever, 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 ever admit that you have made a mistake. Don't let them know you're wrong. Push on to the end. I had a one-night stand roll into a 5-year marriage based on that one. As my practice husband. Chuck keeps calling me his practice wife. I keep telling him after 17 years I think he's got it right, but current wife, he calls me. He likes to keep me on my toes. But, you know, and the other rule was that it wasn't all right not to know. You know, I cannot let you know that I don't know what's going on. I can't let you know that I don't know how to do that. I can't ask a question, for God's sakes, because then you'll know that I don't know. You know, I would have been one of those people who drove around forever not asking for directions. You know, I can't let you know. I felt embarrassed for you in school if you asked a question. Because I thought, you know, God, the whole class knows you don't know, you know. I was doing fake it till you make it long before I got here. And so that's how I live my life. And this is without a drink. It was busy in my head. There were always voices in my head. None of them liked me. There wasn't one up there that had a friendly thought. They told me things like, nobody really likes you. They just make their moms make them play with you. They don't really want to. I never would go, like if you asked me to go somewhere, it didn't matter what I had going, I would go. Because I thought if I didn't go, if you ever got out somewhere without me, you would kind of notice that, you know, I'm really having a better time since she's not here, you know. And I thought she was your friend. No, I don't like her. I thought she was your friend. And then, you know, then I'd have nowhere to go again. So I was glued to your side. Because I knew if you had a minute apart from... I was the kind of girl, if I was working first shift and he was working second shift, I would quit my first shift job so we could be together, you know? Because, like, you know, translation, if I'm out of your line of sight for more than 10 seconds, you might find somebody else. And I thought I was an independent woman when I got here. That inventory's a brutal shock, I'll tell you what. Found out I was out there being independent while I was desperately looking for somebody to take care of me because I just could not do it. Anyway, so that, you know, I got all these voices in my head. None of them like me. There's always a committee meeting going on. They're still up there now. I've just learned to not venture in there by myself very often. Every now and then, if it's a really slow day, I'll pop in to see what we're talking about just for a little amusement. But I've learned that every thought that rides by, I do not have to put a saddle on and ride with it. I could just watch it go by and go, oh, that was stupid. Oh, that was, you know. I mean, every now and then one just floats through and I go, yep, still alcoholic, you know. Even after all these, Chuck and I were on some kind of, people ask us if we got sober together. And we're like, oh my God, are you kidding? We've been dieting together for 17 years and look at us, you know. I mean, like, we never would have made it. We met in AA. But I think we were probably on, you know, some diet, God knows what. I was about 5 years sober, and I was getting angry, and I remember like it was yesterday. I drove through town. I'm coming down a hill in town, and I just had this thought, well, screw it. You can't eat. You may as well drink. And I just thought, where does that come from but an alcoholic brain, you know? It's still, it will creep in there still, you know? But I heard an interesting thing. They actually had a meeting on it last week. That, you know, the thought of a drink is not the same as the desire for a drink. And so when something like that floats by, I don't have to go freak out and dig deep and see what happened and where did I go wrong. It just, I'm alcoholic and periodically there's still a voice in my head that says a drink will fix that. But there's now, thankfully, other voices that go, that is so stupid. Where did you come up with that? And then I just back out of the room quietly and leave them all to themselves. But, you know, I was a good student. School came easily to me, I think because I read a lot as a kid. It wasn't really any work ethic. I'm just lazy. Chuck says I'm a type AL. I don't know if you know what that is, but he said I'm a type A personality, but I'm lazy enough that I'm not annoying. And that's probably true. I used to say I was a 50-yard dash person in a 5-mile world. You know, we don't really like to finish things. And I realized a couple months ago, really, I would just rather set up a chair at the start line and wait while you bring me the trophy. If it's work, I'm really not interested. And that's why it astounds, you know, it's got to be good here for me to have stayed all these years. This is so much easier than trying to stay out there. If you are new, this is the easier, softer way, trust me. It takes a lot of work to stay out there. So I grew up in a small college town in Ohio. That was my first resentment. I didn't want to be from Ohio. Ohio was lame. Ohio was not cool. I was supposed to be a California girl, and my parents moved due to my dad's drinking when I was a kid. And so I end up in Ohio. And you know how it's at first grade, I'm looking at a map of the United States and seeing, you know, California and Florida and Texas and then Ohio. And I remember looking at the map thinking, you could tell looking at this map that nothing is happening in Ohio. You know, and where does that come from at 6 years old? Nobody taught me that, you know, but I know now at 6 years old, I was restless, irritable, and discontent already. Already, if I lived somewhere else, my life would be better. If my mother was different, my life would be better. If I had better friends, if I could run faster, if I could sing louder, whatever. My whole life already at 6 years old was, if this was different, then I could be happy. And that I carried that into sobriety. I had great grades right up until I picked up a drink. Up until I drank, it was very, very busy because of all these voices in my head. I couldn't sit still because it was too unfriendly. One of my favorite promises in the book is the one that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease, because I absolutely could not do that until I came here. It was too unfriendly if I was alone, too many voices, you know, and so I was in the middle of everything. I was on the yearbook staff, in the pep club, and student council, and, you know, you name it, I was doing it. And when I started drinking at 15 years old, that stuff just started to go away. I gave away some of it was taken away, and some of it just slid away unnoticed. I didn't even know it was gone until I got it back, because alcoholism is subtle, and it's sneaky. and it started taking pieces of my life long before I was ready to let him go. But if you'd asked me here, you know, sorry, if you want this drink, we'll take your integrity. Absolutely take it. I don't care. You know, take it. Just give me the drink. And that's how it was from the first time I drank. I didn't get real drunk the first time because a lot of my friends were experimenting and they were falling down, throwing up, looking bad. I don't like to look bad. So I just put a glow on and it was enough. I took my best friend out the next day to drink with me. And that friendship didn't make it another year because we drank different from the start. You know, from the moment I drank, it was on. If I could have been a daily drinker in high school, I would have been. The only thing that kept me from it was access. But I was, and I drank with the big boys because I could. You know, from the beginning, I had a huge capacity for alcohol. Huge. I was horrified when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, hang out with the women. I just thought, what? Are you kidding me? I didn't even drink with women, and you want me to hang out with them sober? Anybody else like that here? Yeah, yeah. I just, I mean, you know, in high school, the girls giggle, and they fall down, and they throw up, and it's embarrassing, or everybody likes the same guy, and, you know, they wear pink in public, and it just, you know, and later on, I was running into complications like, oh, that was your husband, I'm so sorry, and, you know, I just, it just was so much easier to drink with the guys, and I could, so I did, you know, And I love to drink. I mean, I pretty much love to drink from beginning to end. I never, you know, I wasn't a crying drunk. I wasn't a fighting drunk. I mostly wasn't a fighting drunk out of a huge fear of getting humiliated in public. That and, you know, let's face it, when fights break out, drinks get spilled, and it's just a waste. So I didn't really even hang out with people that fought much because, you know, that's my beer, man. And I wasn't a depressed drunk. I was the social drinker, you know. The more I drank, the more social I got. I was very social by last call. That was dating. That's what I thought, you know. I had to learn how to date when I got here. My sponsor said dating and sex are not the same thing. And I, really? I mean, who knew that? I thought that's what you started with. And if you like them, it's a relationship, you know. Somebody's still at my house on Sunday, I'm in love. And I've been thinking, though, I needed a questionnaire back then, you know, because, like, when I got here, they tell you if you make a list of the things you want in sobriety, you'll really sell yourself short. And really, when I got here, all I wanted was my driver's license back and maybe to get married again, preferably to a guy that had a job. You know, but I never remember to ask that at last call, you know. I'm sorry, are you employed? Are you married? Is that car paid for? No. I never asked any of those questions. So I went on my merry way. I made it out of high school somehow, probably because I didn't drink till the middle of my sophomore year. I went off to college because that's what you do. I flunked out of college pretty fast because I guess it's helpful if you go to class. And I couldn't go to class. Now, I was not drinking a lot in college because I had not done my research. They still had 18 states back when I went to college, but I didn't pick one of them to go to school in. I went in the middle of a 21 state, so I really didn't get to drink much. But there's this voice in my head. I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know what to say after my name's Beth. I don't know what to say when I meet people. This small talk stuff just escapes me. And so if I would go to class on the first day and meet somebody and I might say, hey, my name's Beth, and she'd say, hi, you know, hey, my name's Elizabeth, and then I don't know what to say next, you know. Now everybody in my head has started up. Say something. You look stupid. You're just staring at her. She's staring at you. You better say something. What are you going to say? It's not even football season. What can you talk about? And, you know, it's like they're arguing. I'm paralyzed. We have to go. And I am out of there. And that was my life over and over. I can't go back there again, you know. And that was my life over and over and over. And when I drank, I was fine. I remember trying to explain to my mother that smoking dope was a social skill. You know, because you could meet somebody you've never met before, and if one of you had something, you were friends. And she never got that. She's not one of us. But anyway, so flunked out of college, came back to Ohio, went to work in a bank because that was, you know, the respectable thing to do. That was not working out. They worked Monday mornings at banks, and that just wasn't working. And a friend of mine said, we should go to Florida. And I said, we should. I had always wanted to run away from home. I had dreamed of running away from home. I knew my life would be better if I got to Florida. I now know they should put a sign on the state line of Florida, California, and Arizona that says this state doesn't work either. I could just turn around. But I got down there, and after 2 weeks, I called my mom. I got a job in a convenience store and didn't know it was so transient that you were management material if you went 3 days in a row. So I called mom. I'm assistant manager at this store. She hadn't heard from me for 2 weeks, had no idea where I was. And she just said, why didn't you tell us you were moving? And I'm thinking, hello, I ran away, you know. And she's like, Beth, you know, you're 19. You could have just left. Well, who knew that? You know, I was looking over my shoulder all the way from Kentucky, waiting for somebody to pull me over and make me go home. And I didn't know. So I'm like a 19-year-old runaway up here. I just, you know, one more in the loser column. And so I got down to Florida, and those were my people. I was in Bonita Springs, Florida in 1978. I-75 didn't even go down there yet. There was three shopping goes and a dog track and about four bars in the whole town. The whole town was 3 miles long. People bought beer on this end of town to drink on the way to this end of town. Those are my people, you know. Get that beer for the 3 mile drive. Yes, you know. And by the end of 8 months down there, I was out of places to work. I was out of guys to date. It was a small town, four bars. You know, how long can that last? And I ended up, I was going to have to move back to Ohio because it looked like I couldn't take care of myself. And I was going to have to admit that I'd made a mistake. And then he moved to town from California. And he had everything I wanted in a man. He had a house, a car, and a job. And he was 6'2" with tattoos. I mean, it just doesn't get better than that. And that was that one night stand that just dragged on and on and on. You know, that was, I heard somebody say a couple weeks ago, we were listening to somebody, and she was married, 17 years? And she said, really, there never should have been a second date. And that's kind of how this was. But we trudged on together and produced two kids in that marriage. We moved to the Keys together, and it was the same thing. You know, went down there, liked it, came home, packed, moved 2 days later with a baby and $400. Hey, let's move to the Keys. And called mom. Hey, we moved to the Keys. Don't worry, I'm assistant manager, you know. And she asked me how I could do something that stupid and land on my feet, which she asked me a lot, and it just made her crazy, you know. But I counted on it. I did. I landed on my feet all the time. I just, you know, I always think of that guy in the cartoons that's walking down the sidewalk and the safes and the pianos are just crashing behind him. That was me. You know, every now and then I get clipped. Yeah, I've now found out the reason that annoyed my mother is because she was one of those people who always got crushed by the piano, so she just thought it wasn't fair. But I, you know, I just counted on getting out of stuff like that. And we were in the Keys. I had a great job at an oceanfront resort. I mean, I had this golden-haired baby. You know, it was a skinny year. This place had 7 bars and 3 restaurants, and I became the night auditor there, and they gave me the keys to all 7 bars. And they paid me. I still think that may have been the best job I ever had. And it was expensive to live down there, so we started a little home-based business while we were there. There was a lot of importing and exporting down there. A lot of need for local distributorship. So we didn't actually import or export. We just distributed. I just thought of it as a part-time job, you know, a couple hundred extra bucks a week, which is what I explained to the probation officer after they arrested us. And she gave me that look that normal people give us when we tell them what we really think. She's like, part-time job, I see. You know, down here we call that sale of a controlled substance, Beth. And that was the first trouble I got in. I thought I might not get out of. But even that, you know, we didn't get anything like we should have. By now, I want out of my marriage. Well, I'd wanted out for a long time, but I'm not going to leave because then it would be my fault, you know. So I just drink till he can't stand it. And he says, get out, and he only had to say it once. He did not have to say it twice. When he came home at lunch to talk, I'm like, sorry, you threw us out, you know. But inside, I was like, yes, finally, you know. So I wanted to relocate in Florida, but my mother would only send me a plane ticket to Ohio, so... In 1984, I moved to Cincinnati, Ohio with a baby and a 2-year-old. I had gone to AA briefly in the Keys because I got fired from that great job. And I kind of intuitively knew I wasn't going to find another job like that. So I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in Key Largo, Florida in 1983. It was a Tuesday night Key Largo group. And They were very nice, but I was 24 years old. You know, I rode Harleys. I drank with the big boys. I get to this meeting. It's a little discussion meeting. They're in their circle of chairs. They're all relating to each other. It was over at 9 o'clock, and they invited me to Perkins. And do you guys have Perkins here? Shoney's? Denny's? All right, same thing. And I'm just thinking, I am 24 years old. There's a Harley park down the street. It is 9 o'clock at night. I've been invited to Perkins. My life is over, you know? I mean, I remember saying to people, what do you do for fun in sobriety? Anybody new here? What do you do for fun in sobriety? And they would go, oh, we have dances, and we go roller skating, and we go to Perkins for coffee. And I'm thinking, oh, should I blow my brains out now, or should I wait till I get home? Of course, a year later, I'm telling them, we have dances, and we go roller skating, and we go to Perkins for coffee, because my attitude and outlook changed when I began to take the action. But I went to one meeting down there, said I was an alcoholic, called my dad, told him I'd been to a meeting, and because I'd been to meetings with him, but I always just said, my name's Beth, I'm with him. You know, I would never. One thing you learn when you have an alcoholic parent in AA is that you cannot afford to breathe the word alcoholic in the same sentence with your name. You know, I met a lot of people who said they sat in the bar and drank and said, oh, I'm alcoholic, who cares? Well, if you got a sober parent and you put alcoholic and your name in the same sentence, I knew a big book would drop out of the sky and somebody would hand me a meeting schedule. So I never, ever wondered if I was alcoholic. I would, like, maybe ease up a little. I won't do those anymore. I'll just drink this. I mean, I did everything in the big, you know, taking an oath, not taking an oath. The only one I'm not sure I did in the big book is that drinking natural wines one, because I'm pretty sure that Mad Dog never saw a grape. And I was a Wild Irish Rose drinker, actually, so. And Thunderbird. Yes. I was so excited. We were down seeing our daughter in Texas last year, and I hadn't been in the store, you know, like that for a while, where they just have all the beer iced down when you walk in. And I came back so excited. I'm like, Chuck, they got four new colors of Wild Irish Rose. And my daughter looks at her husband and said, I told you they were nuts. You know, I mean, just, they have blue. Can you imagine? Oh, well. I'm easily distracted sometimes. You'll have to excuse me. Anyway, so I go to Ohio, and I thought, all right. I went to that one meeting. I got my job back. AA works. It really does. Went to one more meeting, told them I got my job back, and that was it for AA in the Keys. But when I got up to Ohio, I thought, all right, I'm going to try AA. Well, you know, I really thought if I just quit drinking with bikers, life would calm down, but I was willing. And in 1984 in Cincinnati, they were on fire up there. I mean, Icky Pa had just been there in 83. They had a Monday night young people's meeting that had 200 people. They had a Friday night young people's meeting that was 150 people. It was active, enthusiastic, sponsored Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I walk into a big room full of people, it splits into two groups, all of you and me. And you all knew each other, and you were all talking to each other. And I come in and say, my name's Beth, and I don't know what to say next, and that's it, I'm done. You know, I can go to the bar not knowing anybody, and I'm fine. You know, give me $5 and a pool table, and I'm set for the night. But I just could not walk into those. I just couldn't do it. And so I drank for another 3 years, during which time the children were removed from my custody. I lost my children in 1985. I did not get sober till 1988. Losing your children is not necessarily a motivation to get sober. You know, it should be. And I would have told you if you asked me that I wanted my kids back. But even when I was in treatment, my mom had to come take my kids. She got that call that no parent wants to get, you know, come get your grandchildren, your daughter's under arrest. And so here's my mom in the middle of the night suddenly with a one-year-old and a three-year-old. And, you know, she read to him every night. She gave him a bath every night. They got dinner every night. They went to school in clean clothes every day, and I couldn't do any of that, and I hated her for doing it. I made her life miserable at every turn. I would do things like the kids would come see me on a weekend, and I would talk to them about getting it. I was going to get an apartment soon so we could all live together, knowing it wasn't true, but knowing they would go back and tell Grandma, be so excited, and she would have to talk them down. She would have to be the bad guy. You know, that's the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism. If you are in my way, you are invisible or you are mowed down. and my mom was mowed down and my kids were invisible. What my kids heard from me all the time was, I love you, go away. Of course I love you, go away. Go play with your sister, go clean your room. Yeah, I mean, I would take, thank God the beer sold, the zoo sold beer, and since that good Germantown, they sell beer everywhere, my kids never would have left the house. You know, I'd take them to the zoo, but we wouldn't look, we'd look at the bears, get a beer, I'd have to pee, and then we had to go. I mean, I just, you know, and when the first time I went through treatment, they told me that, you know, alcohol makes all your choices for you, which I thought was ridiculous. I mean, come on. And when I got sober 3 years later, I realized that my children were never, and I mean never, inside a McDonald's with me before I got sober, because they don't sell beer. Why would I go in there? I would drive them through and get a large Coke if I had a bottle of rum in the car. But alcohol picked everything I did. It picked everywhere I ever worked. It picked who I hung out with. It picked what I did or didn't do with them. And sometimes it picked without my permission, you know. And I just, I'm on this online gratitude list where we all post a gratitude list every day. And just some of the stuff you see that I forget about, just waking up and seeing, is it carpet or is it cement, you know? Or trying to listen to the house to see, are there doors slamming? Am I in trouble? You know, trying to piece the day together, you know, the night before. And what did I, am I even home? Is my car out there? That was just normal living for me. And the kids stayed at my mom. I went to treatment when they were removed from my custody because they said, you know, if you go to treatment, maybe we won't put you in jail for 6 months, and that seemed like a good plan. So I went to treatment, and while I was in there, my dad died, so, you know, I was going to go be sober with him. But he died, and I was the only child of divorced parents, so I got the insurance money, and I got to drink the way I wanted to drink for the next 2.5 years. And if you asked me if I wanted the children back, I would tell you I did. But even in that treatment center, I was the one that they would come get. Because I, you know, I'm a test taker. You know, if you're a test taker, you know that you are. I mean, we can absorb something, spit it back on a test, and you can ace treatment like that. You know what I mean? I was a star in treatment. I knew all the right answers. I could talk the talk, you know, and I would be the ones they would come get to talk to the women who didn't want to leave their kids for 6 weeks to go to treatment. And I could tell them, you know, if we don't do this now, better 6 weeks now than forever later. If we're not sober, we can't be parents at all. But inside, I had this double life starting that the book talks about. That, you know, we have this outside life that we want people to see, and we have this inside life we know is true. And the truth that was coming clear in my mind was that I did not want my children back. I was glad they were at my mom's. So I was pretty sure I wasn't done drinking. And it was too hard to be a single mother. I just couldn't do it. Like I said, all they heard from me was, I love you, go away. And I knew they were better off with her. But you can't tell people, like, yes, I'm actually kind of glad my children are gone. Because, you know, I mean, talk about looking bad. So I would tell you I wanted them back. And I would tell them I wanted them back. But nothing in my actions ever said I wanted them back. And finally, toward the end of 1987, I just kind of hit an emotional wall. And I prayed one night, God, I can't keep doing this anymore, you know. I can't live like this anymore. And I prayed, and I remembered that I had a big book my dad had sent me when I went to that meeting in Key Largo. I called him and told him I'd been to a meeting. Within a week, I got a box from him, and it had a big book and a 12 and 12, each day a new beginning, one day at a time, 24 hours a day, bookmarks, a tape of his talk. You know, I don't know how long he'd been gathering it all up, but one meeting, and it was in the mail to me. So I had my own big book at treatment, you know, and when I, that night I remembered I still had this book my dad sent me, and I opened it up and I read Bill's story, which is where I always started, you know. You get here and we tell you the answers are in the book, the design for living's in the book, and I never read the Roman numerals because I thought if they really want you to read them, they would make them page one, you know what I mean? Nobody reads that stuff. So I would open up looking for the directions and go to page one, Bill's story, and it would say, war fever ran high in a New England town, and I would just think, oh, yeah, this is helpful, you know? I mean, I'd look at Bill's story and think, he's old, he's dead, who cares? And but that night I read Bill's story, and I identified for the first time. I felt like he felt, I thought like he thought, and I got some hope. And the next morning when I woke up, I really didn't want to drink. And looking back, you know, I think God removed the obsession to drink. But I didn't do another thing to stay sober. I didn't go to a meeting. I didn't call anybody. I didn't read another page in the book. I didn't pray again. I did nothing. So I felt better most of the day, but by mid-afternoon, the voices are saying, oh, you may as well just drink. You know you're going to. You know, and I can look back now. Bill talks about being in the Winchester Cathedral and realizing that when he needed and wanted God, God was there. But then God got blocked out by the worldly clamors, you know. And that was my experience that I, you know, there were several times where I really just didn't want to drink. I asked God for help and he was there. But I never, ever, ever followed up. I was good at surrendering. I was very, very bad at staying surrendered. And the thing is, when we're here, you know, surrender is not an event. It's got to be a discipline. You know, surrender is ongoing. And I didn't get that part. There's a guy in California that says if you want God to do everything for you, lock yourself in a closet. When you get hungry, pray for a hot dog. You know, it's just not going to happen. There's stuff that there's action we have to take. And I drank on and off in early 88, but in June of 88, everybody was mad at me. And I thought, wow, I've been here 4 years. I bet everybody in Florida is going, God, I wish Beth would come back. And so I went down to Florida, you know, ran away from home again at age 29. And I got down there and nobody was really excited to see me. Imagine that. And on June 26, 1988, I was standing in the Fort Myers airport in Fort Myers, Florida. And I didn't have a dollar to my name. I didn't have enough money for one drink. And if I had, somebody else might be standing here now. But I didn't have enough for one. I couldn't get a plan together, and I was hungover. God, I was hungover. And, you know, I thought about hitchhiking back, but it was, you know, Florida in June. Forget that. And I thought about stealing a little old lady's purse and maybe getting lucky getting some money, but I felt so bad. I knew I'd get that little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week, and she'd run me down and take her purse back and, you know, purse snatch or arrested by airport security. I just couldn't bear the thought of that. And although we have met somebody got arrested by the mall police, he's my hero. I just go, every time I hear that, it's like, oh, God, that so could have been me. I called my mom and told her where I was and what I had done. And she said, call me back later, and hung up on me. And I since found out she called those Al-Anon people. And when I called her back, she said, I booked you a plane ticket, but you need to understand that I'm not flying you home. I'm flying the children's mother home, and it's only because I'm afraid we'll never see you again if I don't. And she picked me up at the airport, and she dropped me off at the local detox. By now, I didn't have insurance, no cushy treatment center now, you know. The local detox in the worst part of town, And she said, go in or don't, but you can't come home with me, you know. So at midnight on June 26th, I'm standing on this place, and she left. And, you know, I didn't give it another thought for years of what it must have cost her to do that. I'm an only child, you know. She left her only child on this. If I had walked out of that place, she didn't know when she left if she would ever see me again. And she left because she knew she had to, you know. And I just, the longer I'm sober, the more I see what we put our family through when we're not hurting anybody, you know. I'm not hurting you. Get out of my business. Leave me alone, you know. And God, I just was tearing everything around me apart. So I got in this detox center, and the next morning, June 27th, 1988, 21 years ago today, I'm laying in that detox bed kind of surveying my life. I was 29 and a half years old. I'm 50 now, so you don't have to do that math. And I am so too young to be this old. But I'm laying in the detox bed, and I realized I was 29 and a half, and I didn't really have any plans to be 30. I thought I'd be dead. You know what I mean? I never thought I would live to be 30. I mixed drugs and alcohol. I drove drunk. I rode motorcycles drunk. I drank with very large people in black leather, you know, weapons. I bartended places where people shot at each other. I just should have been dead over and over and over and over. And I realized that day that I was not dead, and I was distressingly healthy, and chances were good that I wasn't going to die. And I thought, oh, my God, I could live like this another 30 or 40 years. You know, it's like this voice just said, people like you don't die, Beth. You're going to just live it out. You know where it says in the book that we either got to, what, die an alcoholic, doomed to an alcoholic death, or accepting spiritual help, and that it's not an easy choice, you know. And, I mean, only we would go, well, you know, what kind of alcoholic death exactly are we talking about, you know? I mean, is it going to be a bad one? Is it going to be a fast one? You know, I mean, we've got to weigh all the options here. And that day, I knew I wasn't going to die. I knew I was going to live, and that no matter how bad it was right then, it was going to get worse, and then it was going to get worse, and then it was going to get worse. You know, I mean, they had some low country boil here, And, you know, I mean, some of y'all, I heard this and it fascinated me that the way to boil a frog is not to put, if you throw them in boiling water, they will jump out. But if you put them in cold water and turn up the heat a little, they adjust. And then you turn up the heat a little and they adjust. And you turn up the heat a little, they adjust. And all of a sudden they're in a pot of boiling water and they never saw it coming. And isn't that alcoholism? I mean, isn't that how we live? You know, it gets worse and we adjust, and it gets worse and we adjust, and every now and then it cools off a little, but we never get back up to where we started. And I knew that day, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it would just continue to get worse and continue to get worse and continue to get worse. And I didn't have a plan. I was out of plans. I did not have one plan on how to fix any of it. There was nobody left to borrow money from. There was nowhere left to work. I just had no friendly direction at all. And I am so grateful that I was out of plans that day, because I just had this passing thought that, you know, whatever those AA people are doing seems to be working for them, and clearly your way is not working for you. Maybe you ought to try it their way. And I had no idea that that was the start of a surrender that saved my life. You know, I spent 5 days in detox, and I got out of detox, and I was going to maybe go in a halfway house, maybe not, but I'd committed to this woman that I'd go to a meeting every day, and who uses lids? I never use one when I drank. Anyway, I went to a meeting the first day out, and I was going to not. You know, I thought, I've been going to meetings 5 days in a row. I could take a day off. But this voice in my head said, you skip meetings before and you drank. So I went to a meeting. And this woman was talking the very first night I was out of detox. She was talking to a room full of people and told a room full of people that alcoholism took her to the place where she didn't want to work and she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I had never before heard anyone say out loud that they didn't want to care for their child, because that was my biggest secret. That was the one I couldn't tell anybody. And she was telling a room full of people. So I got her number after the meeting. And the next day I went to call her, and it took, you know, forever. It took me, I bet, a good 30 minutes, because she's busy. She didn't really want you to call. She's going to say, Beth who, you know. And I finally called her, because I just, that voice in my head, you didn't call people before and you drank. So I called her up and I just said, this is Beth, I got your number last night and I'm practicing using your phone, because I didn't have a clue what else to say. And for the first time, I didn't care that I didn't know what to say. I just said, I am just practicing. And that's what we tell new people now. Just call us and tell us you're practicing. You know, we are probably not going to have deep philosophical conversations when you're 4 days sober. I mean, we're 20 years sober and we don't have them now, you know. I was out in Nebraska with my sponsor, who is 45 years sober, and another speaker who was 38 years. I was the baby at 20, and we had really intense lunch conversation about who was dating who in Hollywood and what happened on 24, you know? I mean, that's the depth you have to look forward to around here, so don't worry if you're not feeling real spiritual in a week. And you know, but I just started showing up because I didn't know what else to do. And in the first 30 days, I really just stuck to that voice that said, you didn't do that and you drank. You didn't call your sponsor and you drank. You skipped meetings and you drank. So I just started going every day. And I found this noon big book meeting, which was perfect for me. They read the whole chapter, which chewed up half of the hour, so I maybe wouldn't have to share. That was good. I didn't know how good that was for everybody else at the time, but I thought it was good for me. The meeting's over at 1. I have my whole day free, you know, also perfect. I knew you're supposed to read your big book every day, because by then I'd been through treatment 3 times, you know. I'm reading the chapter at the meeting. This should count, right? I don't have to read at home. This is why I went to the big book meeting. It had nothing to do with learning about sobriety. You know, but when I did try to read at home, I couldn't track anything I was reading. I mean, I would read, and 20 minutes later, I'd be on the same paragraph, or else I'd be 20 pages in and not have a clue what I read. And even if I was at a meeting, I'd be, you know, listening to you guys read, and it'd be like, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly, I wonder what it's going to cost to get my car out of impound tomorrow, you know? I mean, I couldn't stay on the page. And if it was my turn to read, because they would actually go around the room, and, you know, so I don't like to look bad, so I'm going to count, you know, see which paragraph I'm going to get right. So I can practice before it gets to me. And you know, some bozo always reads 2 paragraphs and messes everything up. Or somebody passes, you know. So, you know, if you're in a room where they're reading around, take your turn and read one paragraph, because you're messing the rest of us up. But I started hearing what was in the book when it got read out loud. I heard it when you read it where I couldn't when I was reading it. And I know I heard it because I was about 3 weeks sober and I was going back. I was answering phones in my mom's office because I was unemployable. So I could, like, go out there at 9, work till 11, leave, go to a new meeting, go back at 2, work till 4, and then that was about all I could do. But I was on my way back, and I stopped to run in Walgreens for something, and I popped up to see what everybody was talking about, you know? And they're talking about, the one of them's going, that was really cool what Guy said at the meeting, and somebody else is going, I didn't even know that was in the book, did you? And somebody else is going, I didn't know that was in the big book. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, the voices in my head are even getting sober, you know what I mean? It's like they were all at the meeting, too. They're up there discussing the big book meeting. I am just going to get away. And, you know, my day was free at 1, but by 4, I'd remember I had no life. So I would go back for another meeting at 6. I go for the 8:30 meeting. And the biggest joke on me was that I didn't realize that people who go to big book meetings on purpose tend to read the book and do what it says. And so I had thrown myself into the middle of the most active people in Cincinnati Alcoholics Anonymous. These people were on fire for AA. They were happy. They were active, and they were involved. And I got into there out of laziness. But I just, you know, I beg new people, if you can, get to big book meetings, you know. Get to speaker meetings. Get to where you're going to hear the solution. Because sadly, I'll just step on my soapbox for 1 second. Sadly, you know, there's a lot of general discussion meetings out there that are an hour of the problem. And I cannot do an hour of the problem. I need an hour of the solution. If I want an hour of the problem, I just go for a drive alone in my car. So I started learning what was in the big book. And somebody said to me, Beth, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I thought, why don't I? You know, I didn't know I could say no. So 3 weeks sober, I wrote an inventory, and this woman, my sponsor, heard my fifth step, and they had me, I was making amends before I was a month sober, and I'll tell you what, my life took off. And for me, I could not have waited 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years to write that inventory. There was too much crap in my head, and I had to get it out to make some room for God to come in. And I am so grateful that I got to those people who said, do it now. You know, the book just says, if you have decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are ready to take certain steps. It doesn't say a word in there about a step a month or a step a year, you know, or when you think you need to do it. And my life took off, you know. My kids were still at my mom's, and she and I talked when I had a year sober and decided that really, you know, she lived in a great neighborhood, a clean neighborhood, a safe neighborhood, one of the best school districts in the state. I was in a 10th floor efficiency in a crappy section of town, you know, in the public school district. And we just thought there was really no purpose served in the name of family unity to drag those kids out of where they had been safe and clean for 4 years down to my level just so we could all be together. You know, I was the disruption in their life, and we determined that I would catch up to them, you know. And they spent more and more time with me. But they stayed with her where they had had the same. They had been doing what they were supposed to do for 4 years. I was the disruption. And so I didn't uproot them to come stay with me in my little efficiency. They stayed at Grandma's, and I took a more and more active part in their life. And when I was around a year sober, we went to a picnic. You know, it was this time of year. And when we got there, I told them they could go play. And I always told them that. They never went and played. But that day, Robbie came back and tugged on my leg. He was 7. He said, Mom, I just wanted to let you know if you need us that we're over here playing. And what I realized was, you know, because every now and then God picks up the curtain and I get to see the whole play just for a second. And what I realized was those kids that day knew they could let me out of their sight and I would be there when they got back. And it took them a year, you know, for a year they didn't let me out of their sight because you never knew when I was going to disappear. And a year later, they knew they could let me out of their sight. And we kept, you know, my kids did 4 meetings a week from Friday to Sunday. They came to meetings with me. My biggest fear was that I would not love my children. I was afraid that alcoholism had killed that within me, that there just was nothing there to reignite. And by watching you guys, I learned how to talk to my kids, you know, because you guys greeted them by name. You guys sat down and talked to them eye to eye so they didn't have to look up. You asked them to help you get coffee cups. You colored with them. You knew they played soccer. You knew what position they played. You knew they had a game last week. That's why it is so important. If there's kids here, man, we need to know those kids' name too. You know, when I brought my kids to a meeting, people greeted them by name, and my kids' gaze came up off the floor, and my kids began to look the world in the eye, and I learned how to talk to them watching you guys, and I am so grateful for that, you know. My little kids are 25 and 27 now, and they know that AA is a safe place. You know, they grew up here. And by Thanksgiving, I had, well, I guess by about 15 months sober, I always say this part to give the newcomers hope. I have my license, a car, and insurance all at once. Yeah. I never could get more than two out of three of them going most of the time. The windows all rolled up and down. The doors all open and closed. And by Thanksgiving of 89, I had a little job and a little car in my little apartment. I had my little kids, you know. And I'm looking at my son, and I'm starting to worry about him because he's got a lot of women in his life, you know. I mean, my mom and his sister and me, and I'm thinking, you know, a boy 7.5 years old really needs a man in his life, you know, and for his sake, I probably should start looking. And everybody always laughs. I just want you to know that's the kind of loving, giving mom I am. I had actually met Chuck a few months before. I was around a year and a half sober, and he was a year sober, and he came and spoke at Oak Street. I had never seen him before, and of course I knew everybody, you know, everybody. And he came and sat down to speak, and I'm thinking, oh, how sober can this guy, you know, I don't even know who he is. And he gave the best talk, you know, and I just thought to myself then, you know, I want what he has, and I am willing to go to any lengths to get it. However, we really didn't start hanging out for another year. We ran in different circles, and we just didn't rush into anything. And it was about a year later when we started to, we didn't even say we were dating for a while because we didn't want to jinx anything, you know. And we made a decision early on to do things different because he had dated like I dated, you know. So I got a sponsor telling me sex and dating are not the same. His sponsor telling him, ask her out ahead of time, go pick her up at the door, walk her to the car, open the car door, be sure she's in the car before you close the car door. We needed instructions, you know. And AA dating is like coffee before the meeting or coffee after the meeting. You know what I mean? You never really know if you should be kissing goodnight or saying the Lord's Prayer. But we muddled through and we made a decision to keep our clothes on because we had both dated the same way. And we got to know each other. You know, we courted. We dated. We got to know each other. We fell in like. We fell in love. He asked me to marry him. And we had been together probably close to a year and a half when we got married. And as the wedding got closer, we just wanted more and more to be married. And in, 15 days, we will be celebrating 17 years of marriage. So and we have been blessed because he is also an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he's got a sponsor. He won't let me do it, even though now it's like, he's class of 88 as well, but he got sober in December, so I love this time of year because I get to help him. Because I got 6 months. Like, as of yesterday, I am now 21 and he's 20. So he usually counts the days till December then. But you know, we are both active and in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're trying to guide some people now at home who are starting to date because it's like they just don't believe us when we tell them our very first, like, one of our first bigger dates for the New Year's Eve dance, we ended up, you know, I made him dinner, and somebody called and needed a ride that lived over here, and somebody else needed a ride over there, so we ate dinner, he left and got this person, I got this person, we met at the dance, you know, at the end of the dance, he took one home, I took one home, we came back and watched a movie. I mean, that's just how we dated. We kept Alcoholics Anonymous in front of it, you know, we did not. I had lived my life trying to put him at the top of the list, and we just determined we will be third in each other's lives, because if we don't have God first and AA second, we got nothing. You know, we got nothing. So he is third on my life, and unless I'm thinking about me, and then fourth is pretty good, I think. So, and it's the same, you know, the same with him. We have just always, you know, kept Alcoholics Anonymous as a priority, and you know, we are just living large. I just can't, you know, we did get custody. Sometimes I forget to tell you, we did get custody of the kids. We moved, we caught up to their neighborhood, and we actually caught up to the suburb next to them first, And we got them bikes that Christmas because, you know, they were coming over by now on weekends and holidays and all that. And we got bikes, and we got bikes for us too because they were little, you know. And so with the first warm day, we go out up north. You don't get to ride your bike at Christmas. You got to wait till like March or April when it's warm. And we go out. We're in the suburbs, and you might have gleaned by now I wasn't the most suburban of girls. But, you know, we go out, and the guy's mowing his grass, and they do that a lot in the suburbs. They mow their grass, and he waved, and we waved, you know, because they wave a lot out there, too. All the neighbors, hey, howdy, neighbor, you know. We're like, yeah, whatever. I mean, where we'd been living, if there were hands up, there was a gun somewhere. And, you know, but we waved, and about the time I waved, I got this look at myself, you know, that camera came back for just a minute, and I thought, oh, my God. I used to own my own Harley-Davidson, and I am riding through the suburbs on a lavender Huffy. How did this happen, you know? But the really amazing thing about that was that I didn't want to be anywhere else but right there, right then, you know? And that is light years away from being afraid I couldn't even love my kids, you know? God changes hearts here. If I can tell you anything, if you're new, yeah, we talk about God a lot, but you know what? So does the big book. It says right in the book, this means we're going to talk about God. And that may be the bad news for you now, but it will become the good news, you know? It will become the good news. I didn't even pray when I got here because I didn't want God to know where I was. So, you know, if you're having problems with it, it's all right. Chuck prayed to his sponsor's God for the first, what, year? Dear Greg's God, because he didn't like his God. Greg said, use mine, he's big enough. You know, do whatever it takes, but grab onto this, because the book says find a God, you know, but like your own conception of God, but it says provided it makes sense. It doesn't say anywhere in there, get a light bulb. You know, get the doorknob. You know, it says that deep down within all of us, there's an idea of God, and we got to unload all that stuff in that inventory so we can find it. It's there. It's that still small voice that's always been there. You know, and the more we have learned through the process of steps and amends and just showing up, you know, suit up, show up, look alert. That's what they say. And just from showing up and doing this deal year after year after year, you know, we have our family's been reunited. We have custody of our children. Well, now they're, yeah, we tried to give them back when they were teenagers, but that didn't work. And, but, you know, we did get custody of the kids. In fifth and seventh grade, we moved to their neighborhood, and they started fifth and seventh grade walking out the door of Mom and Dad's house. And, you know, when we moved to North Carolina, our daughter was in the Army. She was at Fort Jackson. And when our son got out of the Army, he lives 4 miles from us in Cary, you know, and this is a kid that for a while we didn't think we'd ever all even be in the same room again. We had some bumpy teenage years, but families will be reunited, and we don't always get our whole family back or our right family back, and sometimes we shouldn't. Sometimes they are just too sick, you know. But look at this. I mean, look around you. You know, this kind of stuff, I didn't know what I was looking for the whole time was child of God. You know, I always had to be Jim and Sally's daughter, Chuck's wife, Beth the cheerleader, Beth the night auditor. I never knew what I was looking for was Beth, child of God, you know. And what is Alcoholics Anonymous if it's not a big, huge family reunion of the children of God? You know, we come here. We come here and we laugh together and we cry together and we live life together. And what a miracle, you know, what a miracle. Chuck and I have gotten to go watch the U.S. Open at Pinehurst number 2, you know, sitting in the grandstand on the 18th green and all of a sudden realizing, holy crap, we're on the 18th green at Pinehurst. How do you get here from the Dewdrop Inn? You know what I mean? We've been parasailing in the Keys once. We'll never do that again. That was terrifying, but we got to do it, you know. We saw Mount Rushmore this year. You know, we get to come hang out in Sumter, South Carolina with 300 of our newest friends, you know. And that's what I told Jean when I talked to her. I said, yeah, it's my anniversary, and I can't imagine a better way to celebrate than with 300 of my new friends, you know. And I want to thank you so much for asking me to be here. It's such an honor. Thank you.